The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good morning. It's another beautiful morning of crisp air and, you know, arriving here and just appreciating this space and this sangha, and realizing, I think, again, that, you know, the care and attention and commitment and devotion that we do here translates into our life so that we're living our life as fully as we can. And maybe that's why I keep coming back. You know, meditation isn't always peaceful. You know, I don't necessarily feel like I've figured things out, but bringing that into my life is such a blessing. So, my name is Soshin. I recently came back from I was very lucky to have 2 weeks in France. And while I was in Paris, I visited one of the famous Parisian cemeteries. It's the one in Montmartre. And at the different entryways to the cemetery, they have a map where all the plots are, well, the different sections are laid out for you. And people of note that have been buried in those different sections. And this particular cemetery is known for being having the graves of many famous artists and poets. And so, you know, I had my little cemetery map and I immediately saw, you know, those graves that I thought it would be very interesting or significant to me to visit. And so, you know, I went to Simone de Beauvoir and Sartre, or Julio Cortazar, Marguerite Duras, Susan Sontag, you know, this kind of interesting collection of different people who are recent, mixed in with all these old, ancient tombs that have moss growing on them or partially decaying, and the modern tombs, sometimes they have an old-fashioned look, and sometimes they look very distinct. So it's a real treat. And if you ever have a chance to go to Paris, I highly recommend this, just as it's like a thing to do. But anyway, so I had my list. I looked at, you know, this one would be interesting to see, and this one would be interesting to see. And the last one that remained on my list was for Man Ray. So Man Ray was one of the leaders of the Dada movement in Paris in the 20s and 30s. He was a photographer. He also did other types of paintings and other types of artwork, and was really part of this very significant milieu at that time before World War II. And Dada sort of was closely connected to surrealism. And I'm not an expert, so I'm just kind of talking off the top of my head here. But my association with it is that it was interested in kind of turning art, turning language, turning visual perspective sort of on its head. In a way, as I was thinking about it after, very similar to Zen in a way, you know, saying, you know, no, the labels that we attach to things, the importance that we attach to things, the meaning that we attach to things, it's all relative. You can't hold on to any of it. Look at this new for the first time. And so that's kind of what I know about it. And it may not be entirely accurate, but that's what I think. And Man Ray was I knew of him as a name, but not really knowing that much about his work, except, you know, having seen some of his photographs. And so I was like really curious, you know, what would his tomb look like, you know, like the Dada of death, you know? So I was kind of worked up, and then interestingly, the number for him was kind of mixed in, so not near, it's divided up into these different sections that are circular, and he's kind of in the middle, so I found it difficult to locate him, so I'm kind of wandering through, and this can help give you a sense, like it starts to get more and more kind of urgent, like where is he, you know, and what's it going to look like? And I didn't formulate a vision, but, you know, I definitely had this idea that it was going to look like something profound. And I get to it, and it doesn't really look like much, actually. It's kind of like... And so the left-hand side is this kind of circular, ovular shape that has his name in it, and then some writing, which is a little bit degraded, and so I can't quite read it. And the right-hand side is rectangular and has a picture of him and a woman. And it's her side, Juliet Manray, her dates, and it says very clearly, "Together again." And so, to my surprise, like, I had a reaction, you know, and it's interesting because I don't actually care, right? You know, like, I don't know that much about Manray, and I don't really, Dada isn't like some major thing in my life, and yet I found myself with this kind of full-blown mental thing going on, you know, and my first thought is like, well, who's she? You know, how did she get on here? And then I think, yeah, right. Like, tell me he was a virgin when he met her. Like, we all know that these guys were all, like, sleeping around all over the place. And yet suddenly here's this, like, epitaph of, you know, bourgeois monogamy. You know, I'm like, right, tell me about it. And how come I can't read his, but I can read hers, you know? So anyway, I kind of calm down, and I, when I finally get to a place where I have Wi-Fi service and moment, I like, what does his side say? And his says, where I wrote it, unconcerned, but not indifferent. Okay, so that was like a 30 blows, you know, wake up, what are you doing? You know, it's okay to have opinions, we all have opinions, but why are you concerned? And so of course, as soon as I read that, I was like, well, no, I'm not concerned, and so I was able to let it go. But I think it's actually a very interesting little moment for me. Because on some level, that's what we do all day long, or at least that's what I do, you know? It's, my mind has these various ideas about things, and its likes and its dislikes, and that kind of is there. We're not indifferent. Some things attract us, some things repel us, and that is part of our experience in the world. But then, we cause suffering to ourselves when we become concerned about those things, those differences. So that seems like very Zen, doesn't it? Like very, like, oh, all we have to do is see our concerns and let them go the way I just did, leaving the cemetery. Isn't that great? But what do you do when, in fact, there are things you're concerned with, you know, that you can't let go because they're important, you know? I don't really care about Man Ray's tomb. So it was very easy to let go of it and then feel like I had had some kind of experience of equanimity or peacefulness or ease. But, you know, I think probably everybody in this room has a lot of concerns, both in their own personal life, maybe it's health, maybe it's family relationships, maybe it's your job. I don't know, you know, but I know that we are all of us sitting here with concerns about ourselves. Then we're also sitting with concerns about the world around us, the politics, climate, things that are really, really serious. So what does it mean to say unconcerned but not indifferent? The other side of it was her side, the together again. So once I started looking at Man Ray's side as maybe having a teaching there for me, I recognized that actually together again is a deep teaching. Like, that's one of our teachings, not separate. We are together. Why did I not see that in that moment? And what I was kind of unhappy to realize and to have to admit to myself is that really what prevented me from just taking that teaching of together was my prejudice. And so, you know, I had a prejudice that a relationship of lesser length and not lasting the entire life, or maybe isn't fully monogamous, is of lesser value than one that is. An assumption that she or her kin were less sophisticated in their thinking, you know, together again is a little kitsch, a little trivial maybe, you know, whereas unconcerned but not indifferent is like really deep, you know. An assumption that she was less important than him and therefore shouldn't have the same place as him on that tomb. And part of that is the artist is more important than the non-artist, right? So if she's not an artist, she doesn't get her say. He gets his say. And kind of connected to that is that the individual is more important than the group, because there's the two of them, and that experience and that statement of the two doesn't hold as much value as his statement of the one. So I'm not like proud of this, you know. When I look deeply into what caused my reactions, what I saw were not ideas that I hold to, you know, not my conscious beliefs, not anything I would support, really, but basically prejudice that I've absorbed because I exist in this world and these are ideas and concepts that sort of inform our culture. A monk asked Chao Chu, "The myriad things return to one. Where does the one return to?" Chu said, "When I was in Ching Chu, I made a cloth shirt. It weighed 7 pounds. So what are those 7 pounds, you know? If Chu, who was one of the great Zen masters of all time, couldn't help but make a cloth shirt of 7 pounds, I'm pretty sure that all of us have made a cloth shirt of 7 pounds too, and we are wearing it all the time. So, you know, first of all, it's just our own suffering. And that's going to be different for each of us, although there's probably a lot of commonality here. And second of all, it's the biases that we carry around because we exist in this world and we've absorbed them whether we wanted to or not. And we're not aware of them, you know, and so they form something inside of us that can trigger us without our being aware of it. But the thing about practice is that it does allow us to begin to see that, you know? And so we begin to loosen the buttons on that cloth shirt. Maybe we open up the collar a little bit and let some fresh air and some light onto the skin. Maybe sometimes we take it off. And maybe we even take it off for good portions of time. It's still our cloth shirt. It's what connects us on some level to everybody around us. And the other thing about that cloth shirt is that it is, in fact, the web of our life. So, you know, once I got curious about what was going on here, I decided to delve in a little bit deeper to Man Ray himself and his web. And so I went to Wikipedia. So this is not like an academic talk here, like it's Wikipedia. So there's going to be a lot of other information out there, and some of you may know it, or you might find other things. But I'll tell you, you know, Wikipedia is kind of interesting because it's this group effort, and it, sometimes it's actually like a dialogue between different people, and what gets included and what doesn't get included is this kind of this, it's a conversation. And so, actually, you know, everything that's there is just also one more reflection of that web of our interconnectedness. So Man Ray was born Emmanuel Redninsky in 1890. He was an American visual artist who spent most of his career in Paris. He was the eldest child of Russian Jewish immigrants. In early 1912, the Redninsky family changed their surname to Ray. Man Ray's brother chose the surname in reaction to the ethnic discrimination and anti-Semitism prevalent at the time. He was a significant contributor to the Dada and Surrealist movements, although his ties to each were informal. He produced major works. He was best known for his photography. He started making objects, developed unique mechanical and photographic methods for making images. And then they give a little more information about some of his early works, some of the people that he was connected to. And in there becomes who were some of these other women that I suspected were there, okay, who he had relationships with. So, number one, in 1913, Man Ray met his first wife, the Belgian poet Adon Lacrosse. Also, I guess her original name was Donna LaCour, 1887 to 1975, in New York. They married in 1914, separated in 1919, formally divorced in 1937. And there is no Wikipedia page for her. She was a poet. Not only is there no Wikipedia page, there's really not very much anywhere on the internet that I could find. I did locate one picture, and she's holding maybe a guitar, looking maybe soulful, and that's kind of it. Number two. In July 1921, Man Ray went to live and work in Paris. Shortly after arriving, he met and fell in love with Kiki de Montparnasse, her name was Alice Prin, an artist model and celebrated character in Paris Bohemian circles. Kiki was Man Ray's companion for most of 1920s. She became the subject of some of his most famous photographic images and starred in some of his films. So then I went to see, well, what about Kiki? Alice Ernestine Prin, 1901 to 1953, nicknamed the Queen of Montparnasse, and often known as Kiki de Montparnasse. Her photograph, oh, so I forgot to tell you, Man Ray's photograph, you know, he's on an angle, He's looking good, tie, type and text in the background of him. It's a very kind of artistic type of photograph. Kiki is naked. And she's, it's one of his photographs of her. And she's, not only is she naked, but she's naked in front of a mirror. So we get two for the price of one. And here's what her page says. Alice Ernestina, she was a French artist model, literary muse, nightclub singer, actress, memoirist, and painter. She flourished in and helped define the liberated culture of Paris in the 1920s. Adopting a single name, Kiki, she became a fixture in the Montparnasse social scene and a popular artist model, posing for dozens of artists. And then there's a long, long list of all the different people she posed for. And it does, the page does have two of her paintings on it. Goes on. A painter in her own right, what does that mean, painter in her own right? In 1927, Prynne had a sold-out exhibition of her paintings. Her drawings and paintings comprise portraits, self-portraits, social activities, fanciful animals, and dreamy landscape, composed in a light, slightly uneven, expressionist style that is a reflection of her easygoing manner and boundless optimism. Long after her death, Prynne remains the embodiment of the outspokenness, audacity, and creativity that marked that period of life in Montparnasse. She represents a strong artistic force in her own right as a woman. In her honor, a daylily has been named Kiki de Montparnasse. And then after this, in case number one wasn't good enough, we have five more pictures of her naked. Number three. In 1929, Man Ray began a love affair with the surrealist photographer Lee Miller. With Lee Miller, Man Ray reinvented the photographic technique of solarization. So that's from his page. And then I went to her page. Her picture almost looks like a Humphrey Bogart movie, frankly. It's black and white, shows her leaning forward with a glass of whiskey or something in her hand, and some type in the back, The Lives of Lee Miller, and it was from the biography that her son wrote of her. And her page says, this is a little long, but it's so interesting, okay? I hope you think so. Elizabeth Lee Miller, Lady Penrose, was an American photographer and photojournalist. Miller's father introduced her and her brothers to photography at an early age. She was his model. He took many stereoscopic photographs of his nude teenage daughter. And he also showed her technical aspects of the art. Age 19, she nearly stepped in front of a car on a Manhattan street, but was prevented by Condé Nast, the publisher of Vogue. For the next 2 years, she was one of the most sought-after models in New York, photographed by leading fashion photographers. A photograph of Miller by Steichen was used to advertise Kotex menstrual pads without her consent, effectively ending her career as a fashion model. In 1929, Miller traveled to Paris, where she became Man Ray's model and collaborator, as well as his lover and muse. While she was in Paris, she began her own photographic studio, often taking over Ray's fashion assignments while he concentrated on painting. In fact, many of the photographs taken during this period and credited to Ray were actually taken by Miller. During a dispute with Ray regarding the attribution of their co-produced work, Ray is said to have slashed an image of Miller's neck with a razor. After leaving Ray and Paris in 1932, she returned to New York and established a portrait and commercial photography studio. In 1934, Miller abandoned her studio to marry the Egyptian businessman and engineer Aziz Aloui Bey. She did not work as a professional photographer during this period, although she continued to photograph. Goes on for a little bit. 1937, Miller had grown bored with her life in Cairo and returned to Paris, where she met the British surrealist painter and curator Roland Penrose, whom she later would marry. Miller contributed to several important art exhibitions. At the outbreak of World War II, Miller was living in London with Penrose when the bombing of the city began. Miller embarked on a new career in photojournalism as the official war photographer for Vogue, documenting the Blitz. She was accredited into the US Army as a war correspondent for Condé Nast Publications, and she teamed up with a life correspondent on many assignments. She traveled to France less than a month after D-Day and recorded the first use of napalm at the siege of Saint-Malo, as well as the liberation of Paris, the Battle of Alsace, and the Nazi concentration camps at Buchenwald and Dachau. Miller photographed dying children in a Vienna hospital, peasant life in post-war Hungary, corpses of Nazi officers and their families, and finally the execution of Prime Minister László Bárdossy. After the war, she continued to work for Vogue for a further 2 years, covering fashion and celebrities. After returning to Britain from Central Europe, Miller started to suffer from severe episodes of clinical depression and what later became known as post-traumatic stress disorder. She began to drink heavily. In 1946, she traveled with Penrose to the United States. In 1947, after she discovered she was pregnant by Penrose, she divorced Bay and married Penrose. While Miller continued to do the occasional photo shoot for Vogue, she soon discarded the darkroom for the kitchen, became a gourmet cook. However, images from the war, especially the concentration camps, continued to haunt her, and she started on what her son later described as a downward spiral. Her depression may have been accredited by her husband's long affair with the trapeze artist, Diane Derriez. She doesn't have a Wikipedia page. Miller was investigated by the British Security Service, MI5, during the 1940s and 1950s on suspicion of being a Soviet spy. Throughout her life, Miller did very little to promote her own photographic work. Miller's work is known today mainly due to the efforts of her son, Anthony Penrose, who has been studying, conserving, and promoting his mother's work since the early 1980s. In October 1969, Miller was asked in an interview with a New York Times reporter what it was that drew her to photography. Her response was that it was, quote, a matter of getting out on a damn limb and sawing it off behind you. Number four, Man Ray was in a relationship with the model Adrian Fidelin for some time between 1936 and 1940. This is from his page. The two separated after Ray fled the Nazi occupation in France, while Adrian chose to stay behind to care for her family. She doesn't have a Wikipedia page either, but I did find one document elsewhere on the web, and so I thought I would tell you a little bit about her. This was found on Squarespace from the Oxford African American Studies Center, which is interesting because she's neither African nor American, but she's not white. Adrian A.D. Fidelin, 1915 to 2004, was a dancer and model best known through her work with the American photographer Man Ray, and was born Casimir Joseph Adrian Fidelin on the 4th of March in Pointe-à-Pitre, Guadeloupe's largest city and economic capital. I'm going to read a bit about her. Although there is remarkably little written documentation about her, Fidelin is widely recognized as the model featured in an extensive assembly of images by Man Ray and acclaimed as the first black model to appear in a major American fashion magazine. Then there's a long list of people she posed for. Fidelin immigrated with her family to France following the catastrophic September 1928 hurricane that swept the Caribbean archipelago and the South Florida Peninsula, killing 1,200 people on her native island. She came of age in Paris in an era in which the influx of émigrés from the French colonies in the Caribbean fueled the creation of a vibrant, diasporic Antillean music and dance community that coincided with and contributed to the craze for l'art nègre, the fascination with all forms of black culture. After Fidelin met Man Ray in 1936, she joined a coterie of black female stage performers in Paris who posed for the photographer in the interwar period. And there's quite a long list of these people. And there's a bit of a part in here where they've had a hard time documenting her because she got attributed to other images, because when people were looking at the images, they just couldn't tell the difference, I guess, between one and the other. Fidelin appears in close to 400 photographs by Man Ray, as well as paintings, several drawings, etchings, and a short film made over the course of their relationship, which lasted until 1940, when he was forced to leave France due to the occupation of Paris by German troops. Ranging from the Côte d'Ivoire to the exotic, these images, many archived in the Centre Georges Pompidou in France, chronicle Fidelin's relationship with Man Ray as his companion, model, muse, and lover. As evidence in these images, she was an intimate member of an avant-garde circle. And then there's a very long list of people in that. Fidelin's place in history was secured by her appearance in one of Man Ray's photographs featured in the September 1937 issue of Harper's Bazaar, an event notable for breaking an intransient color barrier in the fashion industry. Fidelin is seen taking on an exotic persona on the full right-hand side of the two-page spread. In this photograph, Fidelin's tiger tooth necklace and ivory armband go provide distinguishing cultural markers of her otherness. It was presumably only in this guise that a woman of color could be considered sufficiently fashionable for the editors of the magazines such as Harper's Bazaar. Photographs from the Mode au Congo series and others Man Ray made of Fidelin appear to have served as a portfolio building opportunities for the modeling career she hoped to establish. Man Ray's efforts to assist her in this endeavor were cut short with his abrupt departure in July 1940. Deciding to stay behind to help her family rather than accompany Man Ray to the United States, Fidelin returned to dancing in various venues in Paris. Their correspondence in the period following their separation reveals Fidelin's dedication in looking after Man Ray's personal effects and saving some of his work from harm during the war, which ultimately contributed to protecting the artist's legacy. The last known photographs of Fidelin were taken by a grateful Man Ray in 1947, when he returned to Paris with his new wife, Juliet Browner, to retrieve work he had been forced to leave behind. In Man Ray's final photograph of his former lover, he captured her smiling alongside her new companion, André Art, whom she would marry a decade later. Sporadic correspondence revealed an ongoing friendship between the two couples through at least 1961. Fidelin died 5 February 2004 in Le Grave, a small town in southern France. Now, last but not least, number 5. So Man Ray's Wikipedia says, Man Ray was forced to leave Paris due to the Second World War. He lived in Los Angeles from 1940 to 1951, where he focused on painting. There, Man Ray met Juliet Browner, a first-generation American of Romanian Jewish lineage. And she has a Wikipedia page, and it's brief. It's under Juliet Man Ray, redirected from Juliet Browner. She was an American dancer and model who became the wife and muse of the artist Man Ray. And her picture is with another man, Reginald Gray, who's also an extremely important person that time. Early life. She graduated from James Monroe High School and then studied dance with Martha Graham before becoming a model. Career. She worked as an art model, often for abstract expressionist painters, and at the age of 30 moved to Los Angeles to try and start a movie career. Marriage. She first met the artist Man Ray in a Los Angeles nightclub. In 1946, she married Man Ray in a double wedding with their friends Max Ernst and Dorothea Tanning. From 1951, they lived in a studio in Paris. Death. She is buried at Paris's Montparnasse Cemetery alongside her husband. You know, there's a life here, but it's hard to tell what it was. Surely she had a long list of people that she knew also. She posed for other people. Somebody wrote this, we don't know who, although it's probably actually in Wikipedia, but I didn't delve into that level. So what do we think? So I thought, well, the mentions Dorothea Tanning, the wife of Max Ernst. So I thought, well, let me find something else. You know, who else is there in here? Max Ernst, you may know, was originally married to Peggy Guggenheim. But he was an artist in his own right and went on to apparently divorce her and marry Dorothea, who was an American painter, printmaker, sculptor, writer, and poet, and her early work was influenced by Surrealism. And she has quite a long page. I'm not going to read you all of it. The cover picture for her is her and Max Ernst, and there's two of her paintings in there, and one of them is a self-portrait naked. Dorothea Tanning was born and raised in Galesburg, Illinois. She moved to New York in 1935. There, she supported herself as a commercial artist while pursuing her own painting and discovering Surrealism at the Museum of Modern Art's seminal 1936 exhibition. After an 8-year relationship, she was married briefly to the writer Homan Shan. She had a number of exhibits, and then she eventually met and married Max Ernst. As Tanning recounts in her memoirs, he was enchanted by her iconic self-portrait birthday, which is this naked photograph, a naked painting. The two played chess, fell in love, cavorted with a long list of famous friends, and were married for 30 years. So I asked earlier, what is this 7 pounds? You know, this 7 pounds is heavy. I don't know what your experience was as I was reading through all of these stories, but when I came away, I felt sad, angry, curious, concerned. You know, so many lives here, all interconnected. And it occurred to me that perhaps Ray and Man Ray and Juliet Ray actually collaborated on that funerary piece. Because what do we think can be a monument to our life? what do we think happens after death? Unconcerned, but not indifferent. Together again. Think about that. It's perfect. But is it what you expect? So many unknown lives. Adon LaCrosse, a poet whose work and life are unknown, one photograph only. Prynne, known more for her body than for her art. Fidelin, an immigrant, lived through Nazi-occupied Paris, caring for her family. Miller, her body exposed as a model, then an artist, trauma, depression. It was her son who recognized her. Tanning, really only recognized for her relationship with Ernst. So I thought I would just end with something else to think about in here. I've got like 5 minutes. And that is the artist who always, for me, the female artists that represent the Dadaist, and who was the person that I always thought with, and that was Merit Oppenheim. Merit Oppenheim has a work in the Museum of Modern Art. I always knew its name was the Fur-Lined Teacup. It's actually called the Breakfast Fur in French. Merit Elisabeth Oppenheim was a German-born Swiss surrealist artist and photographer. Oppenheim was a member of the Surrealist movement. Besides creating art objects, Oppenheim also famously appeared as a model for photographs by Man Ray, most notably a series of nude shots of her interacting with a printing press. Merit Oppenheim's best-known artwork is Object, Le Déjeuner en Fourrure, Object, Breakfast in Fur, Fur-Lined Teacup. Oppenheim's object consists of a teacup, saucer, and spoon that she covered with fur. The fur represents an affluent woman. The cup, hollow yet round, can evoke female genitalia. The spoon, with its phallic shape, further eroticizes the hairy object. Oppenheim created object to liberate the saucer, spoon, and teacup from their original functions as consumer objects. Viewers are thus able to feel emotions of joy and wonder when observing object, while also questioning the functionality of each of its components. Object was purchased for the collection of the Museum of Modern Art in New York and was included in the museum's first surrealist exhibit. Oppenheim was willing to sell her artwork for 1,000 francs, but the museum only offered her $50, and she accepted. This was the first surrealist artwork that the museum acquired, and Oppenheim became known as the First Lady of MoMA. Oppenheim's object would become one of the main forces that led to her lengthy artistic crisis, due to its spiking increase in popularity after being displayed in New York. Although it brought Oppenheim a large amount of fame, Object reinforced the public's belief that Oppenheim only practiced surrealism, which she found hindered her freedom of artistic expression and exploration of other artistic styles. In 1937, Oppenheim returned to Basel, trained as an art conservator in order to ensure her financial stability. This marked the beginning of a creative crisis that lasted until 1954. Although she maintained some contact with her friends in Paris, she created very little and destroyed or failed to finish much of what she created. Throughout her life, Oppenheim has been willing to pose for photographers. Her most popular photo shoot with Man Ray deeply depicts her personal stance on femininity. The photographs provided an unmistakable monument to her femininity and her testimony to her unwillingness to expose it. Oppenheim received an award of the city of Basel on January 16, 1975. In her acceptance speech, Oppenheim said, "Freedom is not given to you. You have to take it."